Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Dan Brown's new novel, The Secret of Secrets, marks the return of Robert Langdon, the Harvard symbologist. This time, Langdon's journey takes him to Prague, where a lecture on human consciousness quickly unravels into a mystery involving a vanished scientist, a lost manuscript, and a secret with world-altering implications. In The Secret of Secrets, Brown continues his blend of historical intrigue and high-stakes suspense, but with a new focus on the frontiers of science and the mind. As Langdon follows a trail of symbols, he is drawn into a race against time that challenges not just his intellect, but his understanding of what is real. Brown is the author of The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, and Origin. The new book is The Secret of Secrets, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dan Brown to this week's book show. Dan, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Great to talk to you again.
I love talking to you, and I love hearing the stories about how these books come together. I believe since the last time we talked, this was already in the works. How long from start to finish?
This one took 8 years. Not my intention. I had the brilliant idea to write about human consciousness, which is a very ethereal topic. Scientists can't even decide on a definition. And to take something as ethereal and kind of smoky as consciousness and try to turn it into an urgent thriller, that was a bit of a challenge, but it took a while.
When do you realize that if it's okay, I'm gonna keep going on this? There's challenges, there's things I know, there's things I don't know. This could be a problem. Okay, but I'm committed. We're gonna keep going.
I've never abandoned a book halfway through. It's always just a question of storytelling. I mean, the consciousness as a topic is fascinating and just filled with really dynamic, interesting ethical questions and scientific questions and even spiritual and religious questions. The challenge was how to turn it into a story. And in my experience, there's always a solution. And unfortunately, I find these solutions by trial and error. So I write a lot of pages that never make it in the book. I'm really serious about making sure that whatever's in the book is absolutely what the reader needs and nothing more. So there's just a lot that gets sheared away toward the end of a book.
So this book begins with Robert Langdon, who is the protagonist, our hero in these stories, professor, of course, of symbology, and has traveled to Prague with Catherine Solomon. Now, Catherine Solomon is a noetic scientist. I wasn't quite sure what that was. You explain.
I do. Noetic scientist is noetic science is a branch of science that studies human consciousness. It comes from the Greek word noetika, which means perception. And it kind of specifically deals with the human mind's ability to affect physical matter. And that's something that physicists have known and agreed on for almost a century now with the double slit experiment, sort of showing that the human mind actually does have an effect on physical matter. And the question now is what is our consciousness as it relates to our reality? Meaning, is it creating reality? Is it affecting reality? Is it perceiving reality? And those are really the questions that noetic scientists are asking today.
So they go to Prague because Catherine is going to be giving this lecture. And this is coming before a major book on the subject is going to be released. And the book apparently starts hitting a little too close to home for some in this story. What is it that could, I guess it's interesting of how something, and this is what you do so brilliantly in the book, of how something that seems interesting and fascinating can ultimately be deadly and be worth knocking people off for.
Right. Well, that actually is that was the breakthrough that I had to make in order to write this book. How do I make human consciousness dangerous, or at least of enough import in the real world that people will die to protect some sort of secret about human consciousness? And, Catherine Solomon's book, Catherine Disappears, the book disappears. And the question of the whole book is, what could possibly be so explosive about human consciousness that people are willing to kill to keep it quiet? And that becomes the mystery. And Catherine's kind of an interesting character because, first of all, she knows a lot about consciousness that Langdon does not. She is a believer, from a laboratory standpoint, experimental standpoint, of things like near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, precognition, sudden savant syndrome, all these things that we would call paranormal. And Langdon is very, very skeptical of these things. And so there are sort of polar opposites on that. And through the course of the novel, Catherine drags Langdon toward her side of the house, her side of the argument, to the point where Langdon, who is a lifelong skeptic, has to admit that, wow, these things really are happening. We, you know, I've seen scientific evidence for these sorts of phenomena that feel impossible, and yet they do happen. And the question is, why are they happening? And what is the implication if reality is not exactly as we have said it is?
And often literally dragging him. I mean, and the point of to get him to what she wants him to open his eyes to. But what's fascinating in that, what I thought was fascinating, is that, of course, Langdon is Langdon, and he is looking at his expertise and this historical lore, and you realize that they both are learning from each other, her on the futuristic side and Robert with the historical angle of how many of these, and of course the symbols that play a part in this as well.
Certainly. And, you know, consciousness is the oldest study. I mean, people say noetic science is this new science. No, it isn't. The oldest consciousness science is religion. We've been trying to figure out how our mind works. Does prayer work? Can we affect the real world through our wishing it were so? And so there is enormous historical precedent, both in traditional history and in religious history, of paranormal experiences, visions, and that sort of thing. And so Langdon is able to say, yeah, you know, I mean, the following Bible verse talks about this, but of course that didn't happen. And Catherine could say, well, you know, this is what just happened in the lab yesterday. So how do you know it didn't happen? And so there is this give and take between the very old and the very new, which was a lot of fun to write. And one thing that really struck me as I was working through this book is that this new model of consciousness that's starting to emerge aligns very, very closely with the model of consciousness that is put forward in the ancient texts of nearly every religion. So, you know, the question is, is science and religion finally going to get along?
And it's something that you explore. I think you use this term actually in the book, where it's sort of the often what Catherine is talking is considered to be woo-woo.
Sure. You know, and there's some joke in there about, you know, no, I did not, you know, move to Sedona and buy some crystals. These are scientists who, you know, with degrees in physics. And so we tend to take anything that is outside what we consider normal, and we call it woo-woo. We call it paranormal. It's outside of what we consider normal. And it's important to remember that there was a time in our history when the Earth was at the center of the solar system. And that's how it felt to us. That was our model. That was our truth. That's what we taught in our schools. But the problem was there were a lot of anomalies, meaning that when Copernicus looked up in the sky, he said, that star is in the wrong place. That planet is rising at the wrong time. Something's not right about this model. There are anomalies. There are outliers. There's paranormal happening. And he said, let's put the sun at the center. And suddenly all of these anomalies disappeared. And everything we saw now falls in the category of normal. That is how scientific models change historically. And I believe, as do a lot of people, that we are at that moment with human consciousness, that there are so many anomalies outside of our current model. And I should just backtrack and say our current model of consciousness is that all of your hopes and dreams and fears and memories are the product of chemical processes in your brain. In other words, consciousness is created by the brain. The theory that is starting to bubble up is quite different than that. And the reason it's bubbling up is because there are many, many anomalies to suggest that our consciousness is not created by our brain. Things like sudden savant syndrome, somebody getting hit in the head with a baseball and suddenly speaking a foreign language or playing violin perfectly. It is very hard to imagine that a baseball can impart the entire Mandarin Chinese language on a kid from Arizona. But these things happen. These are akin to the stars being out of place, planets being out of place. These are the anomalies around our current model. And there are new models that arrive that actually take all these anomalies and explain them. I'm convinced that within 10 years, we will have an entirely different model of consciousness, the model that Catherine is talking about in this book. It has a lot of implications for life and certainly even some implications for death. So it's a pretty fascinating time to be studying consciousness.
But we're going against thousands of years of thought, right? I mean, this isn't going to go it's not going to go easily in the sense of this is how we've thought about this all of this time, and now suddenly, even though we have this science, if we're going to believe it, hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, and any time you change course on big ideas that are entrenched, there is friction, there is people upset. And one of these types of people is in the novel. There's a character named Brigida Gessner, who is a materialist scientist who believes that all things paranormal are just that. They're paranormal. They're crazy. It's bad data. It's not really happening. And one of the reasons is that she has spent her entire life working and writing about one model. And if you spend your life writing about one model, it could be that the Earth is at the center of the solar system. It could be that Jesus is literally the Son of God. It could be that, really any the Earth is flat. It could be whatever it is. If that has been your mindset and that has been what you have been taught and what you've been teaching, it's very, very difficult in a generation, as you just pointed out, to change directions. I think it will happen much faster in this case because of technology, because of proofs that can emerge, and frankly, because it makes a lot of logical sense and scientific sense.
You write in the novel, the challenge for Langdon was that he had never believed in precognition. Throughout his career, he had encountered this subject in ancient texts, but he had always dismissed the notion of clairvoyance, arguing that precognition by any name, prophecy, soothsaying, divination, astrology, was history's oldest delusion. So you have your main character who's questioning the very tenets of this, and then he starts to talk about his history students who are asking him about Nostradamus, which Langdon and you, as the author, point out that knowing the future is something that we've been obsessed with.
I mean, we've always wanted to know the future. And Nostradamus, I mean, wrote, I can't remember how many quatrains he wrote, but a lot, and they were pretty vague. And if you can go in and cherry pick three or four of them and say, hey, look, this is the Twin Towers, or this is World War II, really, that is not proof of anything. That is just cherry picking thing that, data that supports your thesis. And that was sort of Langdon's point. But even before Nostradamus, people would climb to the top of the hill to talk to the soothsayers and the visionaries in Greece who would tell them what's going to happen tomorrow or who's going to win a war. It is the ultimate power to know what's happening tomorrow.
Dan Brown is our guest. The new book is The Secret of Secrets. It is published by Doubleday. Langdon talks about we all want to believe in magic or something beyond this world, so our minds often trick us into seeing things that are not really there. This doesn't go well, over well with Catherine, although she is patient in the, mostly patient in the, in the realizing that what she is positing is something that is often difficult to fully comprehend.
Sure. And she knows Langdon is rational. And for example, precognition, he'll say, look, precognition doesn't exist. Clairvoyance doesn't exist. And I can give you all these historical accounts of it, but I can also explain them historically. And she said, okay, well, let me show you this. And rather than giving him information that he already has that he can debunk, she tells him about a scientific experiment that has been repeated in which viewers' brains lit up a few milliseconds before they saw a particular image that they were going to see. And this has been measured in a lab, and they say, like, the brain knows what image it is about to see, even though it's being chosen randomly by a computer. And he can't believe that. And they say, well, what's worse is the brain lights up before the computer has even randomly decided what to show it. So then the question becomes, is the brain affecting the computer? Does time travel in two directions? It offers a whole host of other sort of fascinating questions, but he has to admit, like, okay, so I guess the brain is clairvoyant. It can see things before it sees them. I'm not, this is Langdon saying, I'm not sure what that implies. And she will patiently tell him what it implies.
It's later in the novel toward the end, but Catherine is in St. Vitus Cathedral, and you write, she remained perplexed that humans had toiled for centuries to construct these shrines to an all-powerful, benevolent God during an era when plagues, wars, and famine were killing the faithful by the millions. She wondered if their God was either indifferent to human suffering or powerless to stop it. Even so, it seemed obvious that the promise of, quote, eternal life was an irresistible balm that soothed the universal fear of death. How do you get to that point of writing about religion and the very central place that it takes in so many people's lives, and then the scientific of saying, okay, but ...
Well, I think it's important to remember that there has never been a religion that has survived that has not promised life after death. From a scientific standpoint, a psychological standpoint, fear is our greatest unknown, the fear of death, rather. It is the one thing that unites all people on the earth. It doesn't matter what religion you are, where you come from, what language you speak, your demographic. We are all afraid of death. And religion very, very efficiently promises life after death. It is the one thing that religion can give us that we cannot get anywhere else. And so the question now is, well, what if science is starting to imply that, maybe some fragment of consciousness survives past death? And here is the scientific evidence to show that, to suggest that, and to support that. It's this fascinating time when religion can turn around and say, I told you so. So it'll be curious to see what happens.
As you were writing the novel and realizing how this was coming together, was a golem always going to be a part of the story?
Sure. The golem is he's a myth from Prague, a monster that's made out of the clay from the banks of the Vltava River, a big humanoid creature made out of clay that, using Kabbalistic magic, is brought to life. And he is a protector of the Jewish people in this Prague myth. And he is sort of activated and deactivated by writing certain Hebrew letters on his forehead. And I chose him for a number of reasons. The first is that he is a protector. That is his role in the ancient myth. First of all, he's tied to Prague, which is where the book is set, and I wanted to use some of that Prague history. Second of all, he's a protector, and there is a character in the novel, without giving up too much, who considers themselves a protector and is a perfect foil for the golem. And also, we're writing about what turns out to be non-local consciousness, how consciousness can be infused into a mind, the mind receives it. And the golem is a perfect example of that, a lifeless blob of clay that receives a consciousness that can be turned on and off like a radio, which is very similar to the new science of consciousness. So he's just a perfect foil for so many parts of the novel.
The other part of the novel that I found to be fascinating is because you're you know, write what you know, right? Is publishing, and that of bringing us to the headquarters of Penguin Random House, and what's going on there, which is also a technological story, but really interesting.
Yeah, you know what? That's sort of the funny thing. Readers are smart people, and you think of all things that they're going to be interested in is, like, how does a book get here to my hands? somebody has an idea and starts writing, but there's a lot that happens between that moment when I'm typing on my computer and you're holding a book. And some of it is it could be as simple as why do editors decide to buy books? What books do they decide to buy and what books do they decide not to buy? How are books edited? How are they kept private? If it's a big book that a lot of people have interest in, how do we not leak them? How do we bring in jacket designers and artists and proofreaders and fact checkers and translators without letting this book out into the public? So there's a lot of that. And I know we've talked a lot today, Joe, about science and consciousness. Above all, it's important to remember this is a Langdon book. It's a chase. It's a treasure hunt. It's a love story. And, for those who've read my books, you know that Langdon is very lucky in love. And in this book, I wanted to do something a little different and connect him with somebody from his past, a colleague with which he's always had a flirtatious romance that's never really been consummated. And so you get to see them fall in love. And it's just a fun, different side of Langdon this time.
Do you want that to continue in the sense of would do you see this character becoming a bit more settled?
Perhaps romantically, but I see him becoming more and more unsettled by what he is learning about the world, only because that is his experience mirrors my experience. 8 years ago, if you had asked me, do you believe in life after death? Absolutely not. Flat no. When we die, it's a full stop, total blackness. We are computers, whose cables have been cut, and that's it. And 8 years later, having spent a lot of time reading everything I can on this topic and talking to physicists, thanatologists, noetic scientists, I've come out the other side with the belief that some portion of our consciousness does survive death. And the way it was explained to me by somebody who's had a near-death experience that really stuck with me, this man said that after his near-death experience, he said, this is what it feels like. It feels like you're in a rainstorm and your whole life, you're just a single raindrop and you're just falling to earth. And you're surrounded by all these other raindrops falling to earth. And you can perceive that there's a lot of raindrops around you, but you're just one of them. You're a person, you're an individual. And that's the way you live your life in this big thing called a storm. And then in the moment of death, you hit the ocean. And for a split second, you're still a raindrop. And then poof, you become part of this massive, massive entangled field. That really is so different from anything you could have imagined that it's actually impossible to imagine, but there you are as part of a greater whole. And I thought that was a fascinating way to look at it. And Langdon sort of talks about that in the book, all these people who've had these near-death experiences and all these experiences are the same, no matter what religion you are, no matter what your beliefs are, everybody has the same experience, which would imply it's not a hallucination or imagination, it's something different.
It's a long book, but what I want to point out is the number of chapters, which is over 100, and the pacing of it is so incredible and relentless, which I know you and I have talked about in the past. It's fascinating how you're able to do that. Are there ever when you have such big issues like human consciousness, to make that peppy? In the sense of keeping it going, to the point of having it be so propulsive.
Yeah, I mean that is the challenge. That's why this book took 8 years. That is the absolute challenge to take something that is, first of all, quite complicated and distill it to a place, A, that I understand it, and B, that I can explain it to somebody who is not a scientist in any way, shape, or form. Whoever it happens to be is not a physicist and actually doesn't even like science. That's the first challenge, to get it in that form. And then the second challenge, to make it peppy, that has to do with making sure that the science is not a tangent, but it is absolutely relevant to the plot. That whoever is explaining the science, whatever conversation is taking place, is not just sort of an aside. It is needs to be solved and understood before the characters can take the next step. That way it feels utterly relevant to the story. It feels like you haven't, like the author isn't saying like, hey, Langdon's asleep for a few hours. Let me take 50 pages and tell you about this thing that I think is really cool. That is not a luxury I ever give myself. There's all sorts of things I'd love to write, but I throw them out if they're not relevant to the plot.
So when you are putting it together, is all your research done in advance? I mean, for the most part, like you have to fully understand about what you want and what you want to write about in terms of human consciousness before you take on the project.
Certainly. And yet in a field like human consciousness that is constantly evolving,
Yes.
in a book that takes 8 years, you're playing a bit of it's like riding on a treadmill sort of, that keeps speeding up. So it's kind of an interesting question that you ask. The real challenge, I think, is to stay ahead of what's happening in the world, at least in the mainstream. And simultaneously to make sure that it's totally relevant to the story you're telling. Those are really the only two things I could say about that, that it's really just a question of making sure that the science stays relevant.
Do you have a sense, I mean, I'm sure you do from talking to readers, but of what it is about this guy, Robert Langdon, and what it is about your storytelling ability with this character that has struck such a chord?
Yeah, I think one thing I think that readers appreciate is that he's this will sound crazy, he's nonviolent. You know, he uses his mind to get out of situations. He never pulls a gun. He doesn't know karate. He just, you know, has to figure it out. So much so that when we made Da Vinci Code with Tom Hanks and Ron Howard, there was a document between all of us that said Langdon, you know, in the movies can't learn how to use a weapon. He can't suddenly become a martial arts master. He has to be Langdon. And so that's sort of the first thing that I think strikes them. The other is that Langdon has this knack of showing people secrets hidden in plain sight, meaning changing your perspective about something. You say, I've seen that my whole life and I never thought of it that way. And that is his skill. He understands entanglement, this idea that things are connected in ways that we can't see, that the crucifix is attached to this, is attached to this, and all of this is related. And just something as simple as so many people have come up to me and say, after this book, I cannot see the Starbucks logo the same way.
Right.
Every time I see a Starbucks, I think of you. And it's a simple little thing. I mean, it's a very simple logo. And Langdon just points out something that's not right about it. And in a funny way, not disrespectful, just sort of saying, hey, you know, this is kind of a funny corporate logo if you really look at it. And so there's a lot of things like that in these books. You know, FedEx was in the last book. People tell me they can't see FedEx the same way. Just little things that relate to the real world and even beliefs, you know, knocking on wood. Where does that come from? Things that sort of come up in your daily life as they're seen from a different point of view.
Dan Brown's new novel is The Secret of Secrets. It is published by Doubleday. Dan, it's always a thrill to speak to you. Thank you so much for the great book. So much fun to read and always a delight to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Fun to be here.
Dan Brown's new novel is The Secret of Secrets, published by Doubleday. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.